you got it dialed in. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
We have Wade Adams stopping by in the second half hour, telling about the year of nanotechnology at Rice, and of course, the voice of reason at the end of the program, another visit to the Den of Strangers, and the fountain of youthless information. But first, remember last week when Edward Morse, the nuclear scientist, was on the program, and he said...
That's an oxymoron. Clean coal doesn't exist.
Well, we wanted to find out ourselves about what's going on with clean coal, so we checked in with Jeff Chapman with the Carbon Capture and Storage Association based in London. Tell me about the term clean coal. Do you have a definition of that, or can you address that at all? We've been told there's no such thing.
Okay. I think if you start from the lovely lovely concept of a nice coal open fire, which but unfortunately produces a lot of dirty material in the exhaust, you can remove all this dirty material. The kind of contaminant that you get in power station exhausts would be oxides of nitrogen, oxides of sulfur, particles, and some small amount of heavy metals. And you can remove all of those easily. And then finally, you can collect the CO2. So literally, coal becomes clean. And furthermore, you can extend this concept by taking coal, and you can gasify it. You can easily gasify coal just by heating it up. And the gas that comes off contains a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. And you can chemically convert this, and you can clean it into pure hydrogen. And you can use that hydrogen as a fuel in power plants, or in vehicles, or in homes and offices and factories. And so this is a way to make coal totally clean.
Well, since we know that the world has a reservoir of coal, I mean, the United States is loaded with it, and so is China, and I understand that 80% of the power generated in a country like Denmark comes from coal-generated furnaces. And you see, then, that coal has a very bright future. We will continue to use coal and that. Is that right?
I think coal has an extremely bright future. Yes, indeed, for that reason. We can solve the problem of climate change, and we can continue to use coal. In other places, such as in South Africa and also in China, they make gasoline and diesel fuel from coal.
Well, now, who pays the freight of being able to take this CO2 out of the coal? Is it the coal companies, and they pass that on then to the electric companies, or how does that happen?
Well, it's a moot point. This is a very expensive process, in the sense that it's very, very, very big plant. It's a very cost-effective process when you compare it to other methods of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But it just happens to be to come in very large slugs. But it has the benefit of the economy of scale. Who pays for it? Well, ultimately, if you're talking about electricity production, the consumer has to pay for it, because basically the consumer will have to use electricity that is generated in some way that doesn't produce emissions, and that could be by nuclear power, or it could be by wind farms, or it could be by clean coal.
Well, the nuclear power people are saying that once a nuclear power plant is built, that after about 10 years or so, that it becomes free energy, that it's already been paid for. But this sounds like if you're using coal, that it's going to be a continuous cost to take the carbon out of the coal.
Well, it's never actually free because you're also building up waste product with nuclear power plants, which has got to be disposed of one day. So you have to put away money to one day decommission the plant and dispose of the waste material.
Mm.
So it's never actually free at all. And of course, the capital cost of a nuclear power plant is incredibly high and gets written down over the lifetime of the plant. So it's not really true to say that nuclear power is free.
Okay, I guess we need to move on from the subject of clean coal. It seems the nuclear people say that it's an oxymoron. There's no such a thing as clean coal. And the coal people say, well, you know, nuclear isn't any cleaner either when you factor in the other things. But now I want to talk to you about that new research paper from Houston that's threatening to blow a hole in the growing political support for carbon capture and storage. In fighting global warming. The document, and we touched on this briefly last week, Jeff, from Houston University, claims that governments wanting to use carbon sequestration have overestimated its value and said that it would take a reservoir the size of a small U.S. state to hold all the CO2 produced by just one power company. And the paper goes on to say the previous modeling has hugely underestimated the space needed to store CO2 because it was based on the totally erroneous premise that the pressure feeding the carbon into the rock structures would be constant. And their quote was, it's like putting a bicycle pump up against a wall. It would be hard to inject CO2 into a closed system without eventually producing so much pressure that it fractures the rock and allows the carbon to migrate to other zones and possibly escape to the surface. So you say not only is CO2 sequestration being done and has been done, but that it's absolutely essential that we do it.
We don't have the time to hang about waiting to develop sophisticated new technologies. We will continue to use fossil fuels for a very long time into the future, and those fossil fuels are going to produce CO2 emissions, and we have to deal with it. So there is no option at all but to store the carbon dioxide deep underground where it will never see the light of day. After all, it's only putting the carbon back where it came from.
Well, then, are you storing it, what, in caverns that are created by the extraction of oil and natural gas, or where's this going?
The first part of the process is the capture process, obviously, and the simplest way to capture CO2 is to scrub the flue gases of power plants and industrial plants with a solution which absorbs CO2. Having absorbed the CO2, you take away the solution, you boil it literally, and the CO2 is evaporated off. You then collect the CO2 and compress it, and you pump it away either by pipeline or even by ship, and that's where the ships come in, and you take it away to the point where you store it. You can store it in very deep underground geological formations. These geological formations could be partly depleted gas reservoirs or oil reservoirs. They could be so-called saline formations, which is exactly the same really as an oil or gas reservoir, except it doesn't contain oil or gas, it contains salt water. So basically, the process involves injecting the CO2 into the tiny interstices of porous rock. And it absorbs it like a sponge. The CO2 at this point is in a dense fluid phase. So it's rather like water, really. It's a liquid.
That's what's going to be my next question, because CO2 is a gas that, of course, created from burning of a solid like coal or a liquid like gasoline or oil, and then it's transformed into another liquid that is not combustible, but it can be stored?
Well, let me put it this way: that you have experienced CO2 as a liquid because you have it in fire extinguishers. Fire extinguishers contain liquid CO2.
Oh, okay.
The gas when you release the pressure.
Oh, okay.
Deep underground, it's to all intents and purposes a liquid under those pressures.
And it would remain a liquid; it won't escape.
It won't escape. Well, the point is that you have to choose a reservoir in which to store the CO2, which first of all has a very high injectivity. In other words, and this is what that paper was referring to. In other words, you can inject the CO2 into the porous rock. Secondly, it must have a big volume so that you can store many millions of tons of it. Thirdly, it must have a layer of impervious rock over the top. And the reason why we have oil and gas reservoirs is because that material has collected underneath an impervious layer of rock.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first instance, we can select reservoirs that have got an impervious layer over the top and an impervious layer somewhere above that, and possibly a third impervious layer somewhere above that, so that you have ultimate containment. When you inject the CO2 into, say, a saline formation, it tends to rise, not by pressure, because the pressure is very high down there and it's in equilibrium with the pressure around it, but because it's a little bit more buoyant than salt water.
Okay.
As time goes on, it tends to form a hydrate with the water, a kind of salt, and that is more dense than water, so it tends to fall.
All right.
So you have a lot of different mechanisms that hold the CO2 in place. First of all, you've got the sponge mechanism. Secondly, you've got the so-called cap rock, the impervious layer.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, you've got this hydration element, which makes it more dense.
Well, Jeff, I'm trying to envision all this. Now, you could take a power plant, let's say in Denmark or in Britain or someplace, with burning coal, and you capture the CO2 in a liquid form, and then you ship it by rail or ship or someplace, and until you get it to wherever this particular reservoir is that you're going to put it. And who owns these reservoirs?
Well, that's a moot point, and the legal situation about the ownership of the underground space varies from country to country.
Mm.
And certainly here in the UK, we intend to store CO2 deep under the bed of the North Sea, and it so happens that the Crown owns that space, so we will literally have to pay the Crown a small rental to store the CO2 there.
Now, how long do you get to pay rental on the storage of CO2? Is that indefinitely?
No, not permanently. There'll be a one-off payment at the time the CO2 is stored.
Oh, okay, I see. And that's what you're shooting for everywhere, huh?
The space underneath the ground is owned by the landowner generally.
Okay, and this is being done right now. Tell us where.
Okay, well, the first thing I should tell you is that in Texas, you have been storing CO2 in oil reservoirs for almost the last 40 years.
For how long did you say?
40 years.
Forty years.
40.
Wow, that we had no idea. Where? Tell us about that.
Well, actually, I've got to start a little bit from first principles, I'm afraid, because CO2 under the conditions of temperature and pressure that deep underground is a dense phase fluid, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
It's not actually quite technically a liquid,
okay,
but to all intents and purposes it is a liquid because it has the same density.
All right.
But it has two very, very special properties.
Mm-hmm.
One is that it has a very low viscosity, because it's not quite a liquid.
Okay.
And the other one is that it's a very voracious solvent, like dry cleaning fluid. CO2 is actually used as a solvent in industrial processes and for making extracts for food use.
Mm-hmm.
The combination of these properties means that when you inject it into an oil reservoir, it literally dissolves the crude oil and sweeps it towards the production well. So you can get much more oil out of oil reservoirs. I've heard it estimated that at least a third more oil has been extracted out of the oil wells of Texas using CO2 than otherwise would have been the case without it.
This is an incredible revelation. I hadn't heard of this ever happening before. This is just new material for me. Thank you so much.
That's okay. But the CO2 which is used in Texas is not at the moment generally industrial CO2, although it's likely to be in the future.
Yeah.
It's naturally occurring underground CO2. You see, there are also CO2 reservoirs exactly the same as there are natural gas and oil reservoirs. And so, basically, you take CO2 out of the ground, pipe it away, pump it down into an oil well, and so it stays in the ground again.
Jeff, where are you going from here, and how is your organization growing?
Well, the organization, well, as you can see, our organization has grown from 11 members to 82 members over 4 years, and we continue to sign up new members. Our membership reads like a kind of who's who of the energy industry. Where are we going from here? Well, we need to get a good number of projects. There are three commercial size projects. If I ignore the Texas Enhanced Oil Recovery, there are three commercial size projects operating in the world at the moment. One's in the middle of the North Sea. One's in Algeria, and one's in, the CO2 is raised in North Dakota and is stored in Saskatchewan, actually.
Oh, right.
So we now need to get onto a phase of building a lot of projects so that we can gain a lot of experience. We can begin to start reducing the cost, the operating cost as well as the capital cost. And we can get to understand how we can build these quickly. We are going to need to build them quickly because we are going to have to build a lot of them in the world. So the first phase is to get the first project underway. And there are plans for quite a number of projects in the USA. There are plans for another four projects in Canada. We have plans to build four projects in the UK. Across Europe, there are plans to build up to 12 projects, and there are also plans to build them in Australia, the Middle East, and also in China.
I was going to ask you about that, because China, India, Brazil, I guess, and some other places have said they're not going to sign on to any kind of a treaty that limits CO2 production to, raising the temperature by 2 degrees or 3 degrees centigrade anytime soon. So what are you doing with China?
No, that's not quite true. In the Chinese and over 100 other countries now have agreed to certain voluntary targets after the agreement that was brokered by President Obama in Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain limits on it now. They aren't absolute limits, I have to say, but it's a step. It's a good step in the right direction because they're limited to growth.
So you do see doing business in China as a real prospect then in the future?
Oh, absolutely. And it's very important that we equip all of these thousands of coal-fired power stations in China with carbon capture and storage. I mean, that is a massive problem to the rest of the world. China's emissions are now greater than the emissions of the USA. So this is what we've got to tackle and tackle it as quickly as possible.
Well, I want to thank you enormously for taking the time today to be with us. I mean, your being with us today was really very special, and I thank you so much for being with us from Britain.
Especially since we interrupted your vacation. It's very good of you to be here.
On the beach on the south coast, and we've just arrived here, so it's so that's why I gave you the mobile number in case we were in transit or something.
On the south coast, isn't it a little early to be on the beach there in England? I mean, it can be kind of cold this time of the year, can't it?
You can be on the beach here anytime. It's winter, it's beautiful.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, I was in London back a few years ago. As a matter of fact, I was there when Charles and Camilla got married. I don't know if you remember that or not. That was a fun time because the Pope died about the same week as we were there. And Charles and Camilla were scheduled to be married on a Friday, and the Pope's funeral was going to be on a Friday. And somebody asked the Vatican, said, look, are you going to postpone the funeral because Charles and Camilla's wedding? And they said, Charles who? And that really, boy, I'll tell you what, there was grousing on the street from the British subjects that I ran into that day. And then Charles was asked if he was going to put off the wedding until after the Pope's funeral, and he said, no, absolutely not. He says, we've got people invited from all over the world. He says, there's no way in the world we're going to put this off. Well, Mum happened to be up in Scotland at the time, and she got back into Buckingham Palace about midweek, and reports in the newspapers were that she called Charles and said, you will postpone the marriage and will attend the funeral. So then there was really grousing on the street because the British subjects that I ran into said, well, you know, Henry threw the Catholics out here a few centuries back, and we don't need to be kowtowing to the Vatican. Do you remember the time? You were there when the wedding took place.
Yeah.
Well, I was there in the Hilton, right on Trafalgar Square, and I had such admiration for Lord Nelson that it was a real treat being there in Trafalgar Square. So that was fun. That was,
yes,
that was a lot of fun. Yes, Jeff. So good of you to take your vacation time to be with us today and answer these burning questions. First on clean coal, whether it exists and that it does exist, and when what it actually means, and then carbon. Storage, capture and storage. And so those were all very, very interesting, and I hope you'll come back with us again sometime, because we want to keep track of how you're coming along with this project. So very, very good of you. And we want to invite the listeners to stick around in just a little bit. We're going to go to the Den of Strangers and get a little bit more wisdom from somebody about whom you've never heard. And then next hour, we're going to check in with the Fountain of Useless Information. Actually, the Fountain of Youthless Information. The spirit of the fountain, of course, speaks with a lisp, and so that's how it got its name. And I'll give you a tip. One of the questions we're going to ask the fountain today is, what two-word term is defined as the lowest possible temperature? So we'll be checking in with the fountain in the next half hour. And, of course, another exciting guest. We've got an old friend, Wade Adams. Wade is the director of the Richard E. Smalley Institute of Nanoscience at Rice University. And Wade comes to visit us every once in a while and always has exciting things to talk about. This time, Rice University is celebrating its 25-year celebration of the discovery of the Buckyball, which launched the modern era of nanotechnology, back when Rick Smalley and his team discovered the Buckminster Fullerene back in 1985. So this is the year of the nanotechnology, the year of the Buckyball at Rice University, and there's a lot of things planned, and Wade is going to fill us in on all the things that are going to go on. I guess the whole team is going to return to Rice, of course, minus Rick Smalley, who his unfortunate death at a young age in 2005. But Bob Curl, of course, is going to be there. He's a resident at Rice. Harry Croteau is coming in from the University of Florida, where he is a professor. And Sean O'Brien, who's a new entrepreneur here in Dallas area. And Jim Heath is coming in from his university, where he teaches at Caltech. So, a lot of exciting things happening. And then, of course, at the end of the program,
the Voice of Reason. Everybody loves the Voice of Reason. So we'll be back in just a bit. Stick with us. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
O. A. Batista. An error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it.